Division One, now in session. Honorable James R. Reed, third, presiding.
Thank you. Please be seated. Good morning to you all. Court calls 21 CR 13, 21 CR 27, Commonwealth versus Jonathan R. McCoy. Also will call 21 CR 2, Lyon Circuit Court, Commonwealth versus Jonathan McCoy. And I'm going to let counsel introduce themselves and who all's here with them at table this morning.
Carrie O.B. Wiggins for the Commonwealth. Detective Brian Hill with KSP is here with me at counsel table.
All right, thank you. Ms. O.B. Wiggins.
Good morning, Your Honor. Yeah. Wesley Boyarski for Jonathan McCoy.
Christy Hyatt for Jonathan McCoy.
And Richard Blazak for Jonathan McCoy.
All right, good morning to all of you. And so what we have on our docket this morning is we had some discovery issues. Were those resolved?
Yes, Your Honor. The hearing today was set in reference to some fire records that the Commonwealth had subpoenaed. We were unable to obtain those. We were advised that the fire department could not locate those, so a hearing was set on that issue for today. In between, the fire department has located the records. They provided those records to me, and I have provided them to the defense. So defense counsel reached out last week or maybe early this week and said that they didn't feel like a hearing was necessary on that particular issue.
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right, so the issues as to the, what was the fire department? East Golden Pond?
Trig Lyon
Fire Department have been resolved, correct? Trig Lyon records, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
I'll try to do an order to that effect. And it looks like the other matter. And is it the only matter we have bond today? Is that right?
That's my opinion, that the only matter we have is bond.
And is that your all's opinion as well?
That's correct, Judge. We filed a motion requesting an adversarial bond hearing today.
All right. So it's your motion, Ms. Boyarski. Anything you wish to say at this time to argue your motion?
Judge, I think that the evidence will show that the standards set out in KRS 431-525 that lay out what the court must consider in setting the amount of bail, I think we'll be able to show today with the evidence that all of those factors favor a reasonable bond for Mr. McCoy.
All right. Ms. O.B. Wiggins, anything before we hear evidence?
Your Honor, I filed a detailed response. I think the bond is clearly appropriate. I don't think any modification is warranted. The defendant has an extensive criminal history. I'm sure the court, in reviewing bond previously or before today, has reviewed his criminal history, but he's got four prior felonies. And the nature of the offense that he's charged with in and of itself is of such a gravity that any modification would not be warranted.
All right. So, Ms. Boyarski, we'll let you call your first witness. How many witnesses do you have?
Three.
All right.
Judge, may I call Detective Hill to the stand, please?
You may. Morning, Detective. You swear upon the testimony you're about to give is the truth.
I do.
You may be seated. And please state your full name and spell it, please.
My full name is Brian Hill, B-R-I-A-N-H-I-L-L.
All right. Go right ahead, Ms. Boyarski.
Thank you, Your Honor. Detective Hill, thank you for being here this morning. I appreciate your time. I have several questions for you regarding your investigation in this case. Could you start by explaining just generally to the court the circumstances surrounding Thelma Barnett's death?
Yes. On September 16th, 2020, there was a residential structure fire on Will Jackson Road. It was Miss Barnett's address. That evening, obviously, fire personnel and a detective from the state police, as well as the coroner, was called to the scene. Ms. Barnett was found in the home, and it was learned that she was the only occupant inside. Initially, everything looked like just an accidental structure fire. The coroner did request an autopsy, and at autopsy, it was found that Ms. Barnett was bound with her hands behind her back. That obviously, medical examiner ruled it a homicide, and that kind of sprung the state police to start a homicide investigation. So a few days after that, September 19th, I believe, or 18th, I started my investigation. It was not clear who could have been involved in this initially. It took a few months of investigating. Jonathan McCoy's cell phone was seized by Sheriff Brent White in Lyon County on a separate investigation. He had a search warrant on that phone, and there was a forensic download performed on the phone. Sheriff White noticed that there was some GPS in the phone that may be near the area of the victim's home, so he reached out to me. He gave me a copy of that download, and I looked, and there was over 100,000 GPS points stored in Mr. McCoy's phone. There were over 10,000 GPS points on the day of the murder. When I began mapping those GPS points, I realized Jonathan McCoy's cell phone entered Trigg County from Hopkinsville and actually traveled through a nearby road and even in front of the residence. The times that the phone was near the residence were consistent with what we believed would be the time of the murder. That also led us to continue following those GPS points later that evening, where Mr. McCoy's phone was mapping at the Walmart in Hopkinsville. We compared that with surveillance footage and found Mr. McCoy, as well as Ms. Keisha Stewart, walking into the Walmart, and Mr. McCoy purchased a gas can and nitrile gloves. This was purchased prior to when the house was set on fire. Mr. McCoy is then seen on surveillance footage, as well as GPS, basically in the parking lot of the Walmart at the Murphy gas station, filling the gas can up. 2 minutes after he had finished filling the gas can up, his phone appeared to be turned off. It quit displaying or transmitting any sort of GPS data. His phone is not transmitting GPS data until, I forget the exact time, but I believe it's pretty close to midnight or somewhere around 10 p.m., somewhere in that range, pretty consistent with when the fire would have been set. And he started transmitting GPS data, I think, within roughly 5 miles of the victim's home. This also seemed to help substantiate Mr. McCoy's involvement. His phone also provided a lot of detail as far as his communication with other people. I found that he was communicating with an Allison Hunter on the day of the murder. When we spoke with Allison Hunter, we interviewed her multiple times. She admitted to being with Mr. McCoy. She admitted to planning a burglary with Mr. McCoy, and she admitted that Mr. McCoy went inside Ms. Barnett's home, admitted to her that he had killed an old lady. They went back by the residence to retrieve his sunglasses and that he was going to have to burn the house down later that evening. She has recently given more information, stating that she actually went in the residence with him as well. Those three general aspects of my investigation are what I used to build the probable cause for Mr. McCoy's arrest.
And you also, you ultimately charged, as a result of that, Mr. McCoy with what?
I think there's seven charges, but murder, kidnapping, burglary, tampering physical evidence. There might be a couple I can't think of.
And who else, was anyone else charged as a result of the investigation?
Yes, Keisha Stewart, as well as most recently Allison Hunter.
And were their charges identical to Mr. McCoy's?
Not identical. Mr. McCoy's the only one charged with murder.
Okay. You said that you ended up getting a hold of Mr. McCoy's cell phone. But what first led you to suspect that Jonathan McCoy was involved in the murder of Thelma?
Sheriff.
Your Honor, we're not here for a trial. We're here for a bond hearing. The basic facts of the case, I think, probably are relevant for the court in determining the gravity of the offense. The detective has testified as to the probable cause for the charge, and I think that's sufficient for a bond hearing.
I agree. I think that we're not here for a discovery conference or any type of discovery. We're here for bond.
Judge, RCR 4.40 entitles us to a full evidentiary hearing, and one of the factors to be considered is the nature of the offense charged. I think it is extremely relevant how strong the evidence is in this case to be able to hold Mr. McCoy on such a high and oppressive bond.
Well, so we have already heard a great deal about this offense and the evidence that the Commonwealth has. How long do you need to explore that issue?
Quite extensively, Judge.
Okay. Well, we're not here for discovery. We're here for bond, and I think we've already gotten quite a bit of information. I'm going to give you about 5 or 10 more minutes as to the offense, but we're not going to spend all day going into this crime. I think we have a murder. We have by somebody. We have an arson. We have a very, very serious offense, and that evidence is pretty clear.
And, Judge, if I could also add for the record, Rule 4.02, all persons shall be bailable before conviction except when death is a possible punishment for the offense or offenses charged and the proof is evident or the presumption is great that the defendant is guilty. So we're past that rule. We don't have to have a hearing today to see if the proof is evident or the presumption is great that the defendant is guilty. He's got a bail. He's not really entitled to a bail because this is a capital case unless the Commonwealth proves these things in the rule, but we're past that. So, again, I just wanted to state that for the record.
But, Judge, that rule, she's also saying that there is a high presumption that the defendant is guilty, and I intend to present to the court evidence that he is not.
But that rule applies when the court is not going to give the defendant a bail. He's got a bail. It's set at $2 million in this case. We're here for a reduction. He's already got a bail.
In terms of time, Ms. Boyarsky, how long are you asking us to give you today to explore the nature of this offense?
30 minutes.
All right, I'm going
to
give you...
I don't plan to be here all day, Judge, okay, by any means, but I would like to get on the record that there's a lot of things in this case that I think you should consider in setting bond.
Well, I'm going to give you about 20 minutes, okay?
Okay.
All right, go ahead.
Thank you, Judge. My question was, what first led you to suspect Jonathan McCoy?
Like I said, this started out as, from what we could tell, possibly a random killing. That meant anyone could be a potential suspect in the beginning. So we were looking at anybody who might have a criminal history that was similar to the MO of the incident. Sheriff Brent White was investigating in Lyon County a vehicle arson that had happened maybe a month or so prior. Mm-hmm. Jonathan McCoy was his suspect in that case. Sheriff White reached out and said, since you all are dealing with a fire, I think you all should talk to him.
So how did his name first come up then?
Sheriff Brent White.
Okay, overruled.
I wanted to see if he was the original one to mention Jonathan's name. I know.
To my knowledge,
okay.
Yes.
Who is Allison Hunter?
Who's
Allison Hunter?
Allison Hunter?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's my answer. What do you mean?
Who is she in relation to this case?
She is, I guess, an associate of Jonathan McCoy.
Would it be true that she's the primary witness in the case alleging that Jonathan McCoy was involved in the murder?
Yes, as far as a witness, yes.
And you interviewed her not once, not twice, not three times, not four times, but five separate times. Is that correct?
Correct.
And it's fair to say that she gave a different version of the events on five separate interviews.
I don't know if I would call it different. It's like she said more. Not really changed her story, but added to and gave greater detail.
As a general estimate, how many different times did she lie to you?
Lie? You'd probably have to study the interviews themselves and make a count.
She told you at one point that Jonathan McCoy was threatening her on Facebook, correct?
I believe so.
And that was not true.
I don't know that to be true or untrue.
If we look at Jonathan's Facebook records and Allison's Facebook records, there would not be any threats in those records, correct?
I don't believe I have Jonathan McCoy's Facebook records, so we couldn't look at those.
During one of your interviews, Detective Hill, with Allison, you acknowledged that this was her second time being involved in a murder. Do you remember that?
I do.
And you referenced in your third interview, I believe, with her, that there was another case file with her name on it.
Objection relevance.
Ms. Boyarsky.
Judge, this goes to show that Allison Hunter has been involved previously in a murder.
I'll allow the question.
Was that case file that you referenced in your interview turned over to the Commonwealth?
Which... I think she's got an extensive criminal history, too. Which case are you talking about?
In the third interview with her, you referenced that she had been involved in another murder and said that you had a, you referenced a case file with her name on it pertaining to that murder. Has that file been turned over to the Commonwealth?
I'm not sure. I think she mentioned that she was maybe a witness and her sister was also involved in the case.
Does defense counsel have a name that she could offer?
He doesn't, I don't believe he states that in his interview. I'm just going off what he said in his interview.
So the answer is you don't have a name?
I don't, no.
I think I could clarify that. I don't think she was a defendant in any murder case. I think she was able to correct us and say, no, I was a witness in that case.
Has she ever been used as an informant before?
Not that I know of.
In that case or currently?
I think she was just interviewed as someone who was a witness.
What kind of promises did you make to her in exchange for her statements in your investigation in this case?
I don't know if I've made any promises.
Detective Hamby, in his third interview, talked to a rehab facility, told Allison that he spoke to a rehab facility on her behalf. Do you recall that?
Yes.
And I think you asked which rehab she specifically wanted to go to in her third interview. Do you recall that?
No, but I trust you're correct.
And you told her that there was a letter from the rehab that would go to the prosecutor so that she could be released.
I don't know if those are the exact words.
Has any of that been turned over to the defense, as far as you know?
I mean, I think it's just verbal conversation in an interview.
The letter that you were referencing, anything like that?
I don't
think
I referenced a letter. I think you're probably talking about Detective Hamby's.
Okay, fair enough. At first, before any of those promises, talk of rehab were made, Allison told you that she and Jonathan McCoy had been riding around in the Katy's area that afternoon, right?
Correct.
And she said nothing about Jonathan McCoy being involved in a murder during that interview.
Which interview?
The third.
I would have to...
Your Honor, again, to the relevance, I think we're just way far afield of where we need to be for a bond hearing. It's not a trial. Detective Hill didn't prepare for a trial. He prepared for a bond hearing where we could offer basic information as to the facts of the case for the court to consider. But questioning about every specific interview that he's done in this case is not appropriate for a bond hearing.
Judge, this line of questioning goes to show that Allison Hunter is the primary witness and that she lied to Detective Hill.
Okay. One question as to that. Go ahead. Do you have maybe you should restate the question.
I'll move on, Judge.
Okay.
Allison Hunter reached out through her boyfriend to communicate with you at one point, correct?
I think that's correct, yes.
Okay. And her boyfriend is John Jones?
Currently?
Was at the time that she reached out to you?
Definitely was at the time.
And she was living in a tent with Mr. Jones at the time of the murder?
Correct.
How close is this tent to the victim's residence?
Probably a few miles. I don't know. Maybe not more than... It's like the road or so over. It's not terribly far.
I want to ask you specifically about when Allison reached out to you to tell you, quote unquote, the truth, is what she said to you. Do you recall that through John Jones?
I don't think you're saying something untrue. It's probably correct. Like I said, I can't remember any of this stuff verbatim, but I would trust my report mentions it, and that's probably where you got that information.
She had basically, Allison had basically had an opportunity to interact with her boyfriend, John Jones, before she reached out again, correct?
I don't know. When you said she reached out, I remember being with John Jones, and he had her on the phone, and he did not tell her we were listening. I don't think she knew we were involved until she was picked up on a warrant, and when I met her face-to-face for the first time, I'm not sure that she even knew we were involved yet.
Do you recall when you were speaking to Allison at one point, and you observed, you said that her speech was different?
I've seen her change over time from when she was under the influence of, well, a methamphetamine addict, and through incarceration, she has sobered up. I have told her on numerous times that I've seen a change in her as far as that.
Do you remember telling her that it sounded to you like she had the conversation planned?
You'd have to be more specific.
That she thought that you thought that she had thought about what she was going to talk to you about, and that it had sounded rehearsed to you. Do you recall that interview?
Could I answer your question with a question?
Sure.
If I said that in the interview and it's audio recorded, if I put it in my report, then yeah, I would say I definitely said that.
Okay.
As far as remembering off the top of my head, I couldn't answer that very easily.
I understand. You said earlier that you did get Allison Hunter's Facebook records. And do you recall many of the messages involved Allison professing her love for John Jones after the murder? At one point she says, John, I miss you so much. I'm so lost without you. I'm going to lose my mind. I'd give anything to be back in the tent for some dumb stuff. I pray to God he brings you back to me. Please, God. And then later, John Jones wrote back to Allison, hey, baby, I got a way you can clear your name. Get a hold of me somehow. And this was directly after the murder, seemingly a week later. Do you recall those Facebook messages?
No, not off the top of my head, but we didn't talk to her for a while after that. So a week after the murder, we didn't even know who she was or John Jones.
Do you remember Allison also messaging a Lana Lynn Simlick on those Facebook messages?
I recall her saying that name as a friend. I do recall that.
It seems apparent that Lana and Allison had an extensive conversation where Allison says, they came to my mom, someone turned me in. And Allison says, fuck bro, I need some help. And Lana says, I got you. Lana says, well, who is the only other person that knows John? He must have done it. It wasn't that asshole John. It's fair to say at this point that Allison's referring to John Jones.
It also sounds like she's referring to her current charges that she was picked up on that night. She had a pending arrest warrant.
This was on September 20th of 2020, shortly after the murder.
She was living in a tent because she had active warrants. She said that's why she was living in a tent. She was running from the law.
Okay.
That conversation to me sounds like that she's talking about her current charges.
Okay. As part of your investigation, then you interviewed Marcy Marcella, correct?
I remember the name if you want to tell me further who she was.
She lives directly behind Miss Barnett's home.
Okay, I think I know who you're talking about. Okay. Tuke Road?
I believe so.
Okay.
I know she's a neighbor. But the day of the murder, a woman approached Marcy Marcella about a camper in the yard. And I know, putting the pieces of your investigation together, you determined that woman was Allison Hunter.
Yeah, I feel like I might disagree. I don't know if that happened the day of the murder, though. I think she might have visited that residence prior to the 16th.
Well, during that conversation, if you recall, Detective Hill, Allison Hunter told Marcy that she had to leave because her husband would want her back and they only had one vehicle. And so she left that note with the name John and a phone number. Do you recall that?
I do.
And that was John Jones's phone number, correct?
I believe so.
You noted in your report that this was likely the same couple, John and Allison, that another witness, Michael McMahon, described as the couple who inquired about a cement slab on Reddick Pond Road a few days before the murder. That was in your report. Do you recall that?
I do.
And Mr. McMahon felt it was suspicious that John Jones and Allison had recently been in the area, possibly casing the area. Do you recall that?
If it's in my report, then yeah, I agree with what you're saying.
He said that's why he reported it to law enforcement. So that would place John Jones on Reddick Pond Road a few days before the murder then, correct?
Well, yeah, he lived. I would say that's his neighborhood almost.
And something that I found very interesting is when you interviewed John Jones, he was driving a vehicle that he had recently painted black. Is that correct?
Yeah, I recall that.
What color was the vehicle before?
I think it was maroon.
And your investigation revealed that John Jones and Allison bought this paint together, correct?
I believe that's correct.
And you even noted that it was suspicious in your report that the vehicle was painted right after the murder.
Yes.
And when John Jones, when you asked him why he had done that, and when you asked Allison why the vehicle was painted, they gave you two different answers, correct?
I don't recall you'd have to...
Do you remember that John Jones told you it was because Allison had warrants, that they needed to suddenly paint their vehicle? And Allison's explanation was that she thought it looked cool.
That sounds correct.
Nothing from that vehicle was sent to the lab for testing?
No. I guess the only thing from that was those two cell phones. I don't know if you'd call that a lab, but we tried to download those two cell phones.
And that number that you had figured out was John Jones's number, that phone he told you was lost, correct?
I think he said Allison would have had the phone, and she may have told him that it was lost.
But regardless, you never had a chance to search the phone?
Correct.
Okay. Or the messages associated with it, or the location data associated with it?
No, that's not true. I believe... I think there was a search warrant on that phone's cellular records. So as far as location, yes.
And that's but not the phone itself to be analyzed?
Well, I feel like you're saying kind of a confusing statement.
Well, clarify for the court, if you would, then.
Well, if you're saying I didn't have a chance to search, what, its location history? Is that what you asked?
Well, you didn't. When you asked John Jones about the phone itself, he didn't have it. So all the only information you had was the phone number associated with his phone, correct?
Yes, and with that information, I can perform a search of the historical data of that phone, and I would call that a search, not of the physical device, but of the phone itself. I feel like we're kind of splitting hairs on what that means.
I understand. I'll move on from that. Did you, let me ask you, I know that you obtained a buccal swab from Jonathan McCoy, Allison Hunter, and Keisha Stewart, the three that you charged. Did you get a buccal swab from John Jones?
No.
Why did you not do that?
He is a felon, so his DNA is already in CODIS. I verified that with Regina Wells at the Kentucky State Police Central Lab. She's in charge of CODIS for Kentucky.
But you did get a buccal swab on Jonathan, Keisha, and Allison. Why did you do that? What was the difference in...
Because they were charged in this case.
You never independently verified John Jones's whereabout on the day of the murder, did you?
You might have to be more specific.
Well, he told you that he was working in Owensboro that entire week that the murder occurred. Do you recall that?
I recall that.
You never, as far as I know,
verify that he was in Owensboro in any way.
I think that's mostly correct.
And actually, during that October 23rd, 2020 interview with Allison Hunter, she admitted to you that John Jones was not in Owensboro, that they were, in fact, meeting up on the day of the murder, and that she was riding around with Jonathan McCoy. Is that correct?
You got me confused.
I mean, with Jonathan, with John Jones.
I don't recall that. I feel like I agree with your first statement almost with Jonathan McCoy.
Do you remember her saying that she rode out that, quote unquote, rode out that way with John Jones at some point that day, referring to Miss Barnett's home?
To be honest, I feel like I remember more rode out that way with Jonathan McCoy. Once again, if there's a recorded statement and she said it in a recorded statement, I would rather have that be, you know, the official.
Do you have a copy of your report with you up there?
No, I'd have to use probably the Commonwealth has a full copy of my report, I assume.
All right. Let me ask you about, I'll move on from that, Detective, and ask you quickly about the GPS data that you referenced at the beginning of your testimony. The theory on the time that Miss Barnett actually died is just a theory, correct?
Objection. I'm sorry to keep objecting, but I feel like we're having a trial here as opposed to a bond hearing, so I'm going to continue to renew my objection to this line of questioning. I think the court has enough information at this point to make a decision.
Judge, I'll be happy to skip over the GPS location data. If I could just quickly ask about the physical evidence connecting Mr. McCoy to the murder.
I'm going to give you, I gave you 20 minutes. You've taken that. I'm going to give you five more.
Thank you, Judge. The electrical cord at the scene was tested for DNA, correct?
Correct.
And Jonathan McCoy's DNA was in an exclusion category of the electrical cord, correct?
I don't think that's actually correct.
I'm going to object to this line of questioning as well. He's not a DNA analyst. If they wanted to question somebody about the DNA reports that they received through discovery, they should have subpoenaed the DNA analyst.
Judge, I'm not asking detailed questions about DNA or for him to explain what DNA is. I'm simply asking him about the report or the request for a lab that he submitted.
The objection is noted and is proper as to his qualifications and his knowledge.
Can I ask you if a cigarette butt at the scene was tested? Did you request a test for DNA on the cigarette butt?
Yes.
And male DNA was identified?
Same objection.
Helping with the relevance, Ms. Boyarsky.
Judge, all of this line of questioning will go to show that there is no physical evidence connecting Jonathan to the murder.
All right. He may answer the question. If he has knowledge.
Could you repeat the question?
I asked about the cigarette butt, and the result from the lab stated that male DNA was identified, correct?
I do get confused on which pieces of evidence have DNA that have come back, but that does feel correct to me that there was a male profile on that cigarette butt.
And Jonathan McCoy was excluded as a potential contributor of that cigarette butt, correct?
I believe that's correct.
Now, this item was not compared, however, to John Jones because there was no buccal swab, correct?
Correct.
Thelma Barnett's fingernail clippings were tested for DNA, correct?
Correct.
And male and female DNA was obtained?
Correct.
Jonathan McCoy was excluded as a potential contributor.
Correct.
The fingernail clippings there were not compared to a buccal swab from John Jones, correct?
I think you could actually argue that, in a sense, it is compared because the DNA profile is entered into CODIS, and once that's done, it's going to run through CODIS. John Jones is in CODIS. I think you would call that being compared to.
Isn't it true that you would have to actually make a request for that specific individual to be compared in CODIS? It wouldn't automatically be done?
it would automatically trigger a response, and that would give me probable cause to get a search warrant for his buccal swab and obtain his DNA that way.
So simply because someone is in CODIS, they would automatically be tested against every case? You don't have to make a request that someone who's in CODIS be tested?
If the lab puts a profile in CODIS, my understanding, once again, I don't work for the lab. This is information I'm regurgitating from just conversations I've had with lab personnel. When a full profile is entered into CODIS, it is ran against every other profile in CODIS.
Okay.
They don't want to make that, I guess, binding enough to use in a court setting. They would still like the investigator to take the time to get a physical profile from that person and match it a second time.
So you did not make a request that anybody that was in CODIS, though, be compared specifically?
Once again, one comparison has already been made. It wouldn't be proper to make a random request into CODIS. I think there's guidelines against that.
Understand. That'd
be proper on my part.
A hair found at the scene was tested for DNA, correct?
Correct.
And that hair did not originate from Jonathan McCoy?
Well, I don't know if you could say that, because I don't think they were able to get a profile at all. So can you really say that it didn't match to him? I think it's just inconclusive testing.
What about the dime that was tested for DNA? It did not come back to Jonathan McCoy.
I don't think they found any DNA to come back to Jonathan McCoy.
So basically, like I said, there's no forensic evidence connecting him to the murder then.
Well, you'd have to tell me the definition of forensic evidence.
Okay.
Because we forensically search a phone. I don't know if we can use that word on multiple fronts, but once again, I think you should read the definition.
I'm specifically
of what that
referring,
means.
Referring to DNA on that.
Okay. As far as DNA?
Mm-hmm.
What's your question?
Was there any forensic evidence connecting Jonathan to the murder?
I would argue that, and of course, maybe we shouldn't go down the road of what lab results are saying, but there is some DNA that Jonathan McCoy has not been fully excluded as a contributor in the FBI report.
The murder scene was tested for an accelerant, correct?
Correct.
And the samples were negative, according to the report. Is that right?
I believe that's correct.
And gasoline was not identified as an accelerant associated with this fire?
Correct.
Jonathan never admitted to being involved in the murder?
Correct.
And Allison Hunter, however, eventually admitted to you that she entered Thelma Barnett's residence that day.
Correct.
She even said that she heard the victim moaning.
Correct.
And she's not charged with murder.
Correct.
Or complicity to murder.
Correct.
But she's the only witness that puts herself in the victim's home. Correct?
Correct.
And the person closest to her, her paramour, John Jones, remains uncharged as well. Why are neither one of these people charged with Ms. Barnett's murder?
Objection, relevance to Mr. McCoy's bond hearing?
I'm going to overrule this time.
Judge, I'll move on and ask about Mr. McCoy's behavior during the murder investigation as regarding relevance to him not being a flight risk.
All right.
Which I think is certainly relevant.
Sure,
to bond.
Absolutely.
Obviously, you investigated Mr. McCoy leading to this charge, and I want to talk to you about his conduct during the murder investigation. He was compliant with law enforcement after his initial arrest during a traffic stop, correct? In the sense that he didn't try to drive off, he didn't try to run, he didn't try to resist arrest, correct?
Correct.
And he actually voluntarily agreed to go to the police station for an initial interview about the murder investigation, correct?
Correct.
At one point, I believe he was even released from custody while the murder investigation was pending. Is that true?
Well, he was never in the state police's custody, but
in law enforcement custody, I'll say.
Correct.
And while he was out of custody, he had a court appearance scheduled in Lyon County.
I'd have to take your word for it.
Okay. Well, this is when, if you recall, that Sheriff White approached Mr. McCoy for questioning about the arson case. I think you referenced that's where you were able to obtain his phone number. Do you recall that from that interview with Sheriff White?
I know that Brent White interviewed him, yes.
Okay. And Jonathan McCoy appeared voluntarily in court for Lyon County despite knowing that he was a suspect in a murder case, correct?
Well, I don't know how anyone would know they're a suspect unless they were told. He was never told he was a suspect.
Well, he agreed to speak with Sheriff White even at the courthouse that day.
Yeah, it wasn't about a murder, though.
But once again, he was compliant, is my point. He agreed to talk to Sheriff White.
Yes.
He didn't attempt to evade him.
No.
So it's fair to say that he, at the start of the murder investigation, was released, and when given an opportunity to flee, he did not.
Can you say that again?
He knew at that point, after talking to Sheriff White, he was out of custody, that he was a suspect in a murder investigation. He could have fled at that point if he chose to.
I don't think he knew, or even we considered him a suspect at that time. So no, I don't agree with that.
Okay. All right. That's all the questions that I have for Detective Hill.
All right, thank you, Ms. Boyarsky. Ms. Sophie Wiggins.
Are you aware that the defendant has a significant criminal history?
I am.
What do you recall him being convicted of previously?
I know he had some pretty serious, I guess you could call them juvenile charges. I don't know if he was charged as an adult or not, but starting as a juvenile, I think he had a pretty serious kidnapping incident that he was charged, convicted, and sentenced for.
Okay. And you recall that being in Marshall Circuit Court?
Yes.
Does two counts of kidnapping and two counts of theft by unlawful taking sound correct?
Yes.
And then multiple other convictions. Christian indictment, 12 CR 418, receiving stolen property under $10,000. Does that sound correct?
Yes.
Livingston Circuit indictment, 12 CR 44, two counts of criminal abuse of a child, victim less than 12. Does that sound correct?
Yes.
And then a burglary third degree indictment out of Trigg County. Does that sound correct?
Yes.
Okay. And are you also aware that he's got several pending indictments other than the case that is being heard right now? We've called all the cases. We're dealing with the murder indictment specifically now, but you're aware he's been charged in other indictments that are still pending. Is that correct?
Yes, I'm aware.
And is it your understanding that the arson case that there's been discussion of, that he's currently charged with arson in Lyon County as well?
Yes, I'm aware.
Did your investigation reveal any culpability on the part of John Jones?
No.
Do you have any evidence that John Jones is in any way involved in the murder of the victim in this case?
No.
Or the burning of her residence?
No.
Or the burglary of her residence?
No.
Why did you not obtain a buccal swab from him?
Once again, he's already in the CODIS system. Any full profile that's put into CODIS is going to be compared against him. Therefore, it would be, well, it just wouldn't be necessary to do so. It's already been done.
And on top of that, do you even believe you have probable cause to get a buccal swab from Jones based upon the information that you've got?
No, I'd probably have to have just consent from him.
Did the investigation reveal that there was any connection between the victim and the defendant?
There was no connection that I could find.
So this was a random act of violence on an innocent victim?
Yes.
You have spent a lot of time on this investigation. The case file is sitting over here on my desk. It took my whole briefcase to bring it in here today. You spent lots and lots of hours. Do you believe, based upon what you have seen, that the defendant is a danger to the public if he were to be released?
Yes, I do.
Why?
I think one reason is, well, number one, and the state police have had experience with this, when someone's charged with murder and they have the opportunity to be released, whether it be on an ankle monitor or even on a bond, there's a high chance that they may want to flee. They may want to injure a witness. They may want to harm themselves, because for some people, suicide might be easier than a life sentence or sentenced to death.
Would you be concerned for witnesses if the defendant was released?
I would.
Why did you interview Allison Hunter so many times? You've been asked a lot of questions, but why did you feel like it was necessary to speak with her so many times?
She came forward to us. We didn't seek her out. We didn't pester her for more information. There were facts to this case that she's never been made privy of, so we left that in our court. That way we could verify something she told us. She's told us intimate details that no one knew about this case, and it would be impossible for her to know those details unless she was telling the truth. If she requested to speak with us, we would honor that request, and we did not feed her information that would let her steer this investigation the way she would want to.
Now, Allison Hunter finally admitted that she went into the victim's residence. Who did she state she went into the residence with?
Jonathan McCoy.
All right, let's talk about after the murder occurred. Let's talk about later that night when the arson occurred. Was Allison Hunter involved in that? The investigation revealed that she was involved in the arson?
Not in the arson, from what I could tell.
Okay. So who did the investigation reveal was involved in the arson?
Jonathan McCoy and Keisha Stewart.
Okay. Now, we haven't talked about Keisha Stewart much. How did Keisha Stewart become involved?
She became involved probably primarily the surveillance footage at the Walmart when she was present with Jonathan McCoy when he purchased the gas can and nitrile gloves.
Okay. And again, you've got the defendant and Keisha Stewart in Walmart when there was a gas can and gloves purchased, correct?
Correct.
And then you've also got Mr. McCoy on surveillance buying gas for the gas can, correct?
Correct.
And again, it's Mr. McCoy's phone that is not transmitting any data during the time that the arson is believed to occur, correct?
Correct.
And it was Mr. McCoy's phone that cut back on after we believe the arson occurred within 5 miles of the victim's residence, correct?
Correct.
Now, you're not an arson investigator, correct?
I am not.
Okay, so you didn't do the arson investigation in this case, but you were asked about an accelerant, and you said that you didn't believe that there were any accelerants located present. Is it your understanding that fire can consume accelerants?
That would make sense to me.
Okay. And so are you aware that even
Judge
if an accelerant...
Objection. He's not an expert on arson.
Well, she's the one that started this line of questioning, Your Honor. I wouldn't have brought it up if she hadn't.
Well, I don't know that he would put himself out as an expert on arson, but just allow him to answer to the extent of his knowledge, okay?
Just if you know. Do you know whether or not an arsonist could use an accelerant, but that not be present in testing because the fire consumed the accelerant? Just if you know.
I mean, that makes sense to me. If you light gasoline on fire, it's going to burn until the fuel runs out, the fuel being the gasoline. I don't know what traces that would leave after the fact, but I would imagine you could consume all of the fuel that was used to create the fire. I also think you might have to test every square inch of the residence to know. It would be very easy to not test an area, and that's the area that could contain an accelerant. I don't think the person who, in this case, he didn't test every square foot of that house. He only tested areas where he thought it had a high likelihood of being present. That doesn't mean that would have been the best place to test.
And how much damage was there to the residence?
It was completely destroyed.
Where was the defendant living during the murder? Do you recall?
I think primarily in a motel room in Hopkinsville. Typically, his whereabouts were Hopkinsville. He might have occasionally visited his wife's residence.
And do you recall him stating during that time he was living in a hotel, like you've said, mainly with Keisha Stewart and using a lot of meth?
Yeah, I think those are his words.
No further questions.
Ms. Boyarski?
No further questions.
Thank you. You may step down, Detective. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Boyarski, your next witness.
I call Amanda McCoy.
Amanda McCoy.
Good morning, Ms. McCoy. You swear from the testimony you're about to give is the truth.
Yes, sir.
You may be seated.
Ms. Boyarsky.
Thank you for being here. Could you please state your name for the court?
Amanda McCoy.
Ms. McCoy, I want to talk to you a little bit about Jonathan and your relationship to the community. Okay. How long have you lived in this community?
On and off all my life.
And how do you know Jonathan McCoy?
We're married.
How long have you known him?
I've known him 3 years.
3 years?
Mm-hmm.
How long have you been married?
We've been married, be 3 years in January, so I'm sorry, I've known him 4 years.
Okay. Known him four and married three in January?
Yes, ma'am.
Are you employed anywhere, Ms. McCoy?
Yes, ma'am. I work at Treehouse Foods in Princeton.
Is that a full-time job?
Yes, ma'am.
Due to being married to Jonathan and knowing him for 4 years, are you thereby aware of his financial situation, both currently and throughout your marriage?
Yes.
Does Jonathan currently have a job?
No.
Did he previously have a job?
Before he was
incarcerated?
Yes.
Where was he working then?
T-Red North America.
How long has Jonathan been in custody on these charges?
It'll be 3 years in December.
Do you have any savings?
No, ma'am.
Do you own any real estate in Kentucky?
No, ma'am.
Is there any cash amount that you could post on Jonathan's behalf?
Yes, ma'am. Maybe $100 or $200.
And that would be the maximum amount of cash that you could come up with?
Most likely, yes, ma'am.
Have you ever posted a bond for Jonathan that's been forfeited?
No, ma'am.
In any time in the past?
No, ma'am.
Do you believe that Jonathan has the ability to post a bond in excess of $2 million?
No.
And then finally, to your knowledge, has Jonathan had any medical issues while he's been in custody?
Yes, he's had trouble with his blood pressure, retaining water, asthma, anxiety.
Has he had to have any treatment for that while he's been in custody?
Yes,
that you know of?
He had been put on medication for the blood pressure and the water retention. And he has inhalers for his asthma.
To your knowledge, has your husband Jonathan received any new charges while he's been in custody?
No, ma'am, not to my knowledge.
Does Jonathan have any children?
Yes.
How many?
One.
And how old?
She'll be 3 in June.
And is this a daughter that you and Jonathan share? Has he expressed, I know you said that she's how old?
She'll be 3 in June.
So he's been incarcerated for much of her life, correct?
Since she was 3 months old.
And has he expressed an interest to you in being involved in her life?
Yes, ma'am.
How do you know that? What is?
He tells me he wishes that he could be home and helping with Harley, and he's sorry I'm having to do it on my own.
And you are the sole provider, I guess, for the family since Jonathan's been incarcerated?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Ms. McCoy. That's all the questions I have for you.
Thank you, Ms. Boyarsky. Ms. Sylvie Whitney.
Ms. McCoy, how long had your husband been out of prison when you married him?
Less than a year, I believe.
And what's your understanding on how much prison time he has served since he's been an adult?
Since an adult?
Mm-hmm.
Quite a lot. I don't know an exact amount, but I will say quite a lot. Yes, ma'am.
Does 25 years sound correct?
Probably so.
And how old is your husband?
45.
Okay, so he spent 25 of his 45 years alive in prison. You agree with me on that?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Ms. McCoy, you've been convicted of a felony, haven't you?
Yes, ma'am.
Right, so you're a convicted felon out of Lyon County?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Now, you said you've never posted a bond that has been forfeited for the defendant, but have you ever posted a bond for the defendant to get out of custody?
Not that I know of. It's always...
You didn't say if he would live with you if he got out of custody. Would he live with you?
As of right now, no, ma'am. I'm living with my mother.
And she wouldn't allow that?
No, ma'am.
Okay. So as far as you know, if he got out of custody, he doesn't have anywhere to live.
I think he would stay with his mother.
You think, but you don't know?
She has said he could stay with her, yes, ma'am.
And where does she live?
She lives here in Katy's.
What's her name?
Teresa Hoover.
Is she here today?
Yes, ma'am.
You said that the defendant worked at TRAD North America. How long did he have that job?
A little over almost 2 years.
And he was actively going to work during the time frame of September 2020?
No, not in September 2020, no, ma'am.
Okay, so when did he quit working at TRAD?
June of 2020.
Okay, so your statement, I believe you said he was working at the time that the murders occurred, did you not?
I guess I'm...
Well, that's not right, is
it? Judge object, that was not her answer. She stated that he was employed prior to the murder.
Okay, all right. You may ask Ms. Ellie Wiggins.
So June was the last time that he worked, so he didn't have a job during July, August, or September? Because he had a pretty substantial...
You'll need to answer verbally, Ms. McCoy, please.
No, ma'am.
Okay. So what was he doing during that time for work? Nothing?
Nothing.
Okay. So you were working, but he wasn't?
Yes.
All right. And is it your understanding he had a pretty substantial meth problem during that time?
Yes, ma'am. Okay.
And he was technically living at your residence, but you've heard the testimony that he was actually living in a hotel with Keisha Stewart. And you don't disagree with that?
No, ma'am.
No further questions.
Ms. Boyarsky.
Amanda, do you recall why Jonathan quit his job at T-Bread?
His asthma. He went from a level 1 asthmatic to a level 3 because of the flux that T-Rad used for their radiators.
Was he told medically not to work?
Yes, ma'am.
Was he advised by a physician that he should not work?
Yes, ma'am.
And did that physician advise that he had obtained the asthma due to the exposure he received at T-Rad?
Your Honor, yes. I'm not sure that's relevant, but it's a lot of leading. So I'm going to object.
Okay. It is leading, but I'll allow it for this hearing. Go ahead. Go ahead and answer the question.
What was the question again?
What was the reason that he had to quit?
For his health. For his health.
All right. Any other questions?
No, Your Honor.
All right. You may step down, Ms. McCoy. Thank you. Ms. Boyarsky.
Judge, one more witness, Teresa Hoover.
Teresa Hoover. Ms. Hoover, raise your right hand. Do you swear or affirm the testimony you're about to give is the truth?
Yes, sir.
You may be seated. Thank you. Ms. Boyarsky, you may ask.
Thank you. Good morning, Ms. Hoover. Thank you for being here. Could you please state your name for the court?
Teresa Hoover.
And where do you live, Ms. Hoover?
84 Nunn Boulevard.
In what city?
Katy's.
Okay. And how long have you lived in this community?
Basically, all my life, I moved away for a short time and came back and bought a house here 2 years ago.
How do you know Jonathan McCoy?
He's my firstborn son.
So you've known him his whole life?
Yes.
Are you currently employed anywhere, Ms. Hoover?
No. Okay.
If the court were to release Jonathan, where would he live?
He could stay with me and my husband.
And is it just you and your husband in the home?
That's correct.
And you said you don't work. Are you generally at home during the day?
Yes. I have a lot of health issues and get ready to have surgery, so Jonathan would really be of help to me.
How long is John, if you know, how long has Jonathan lived in Kentucky?
All of his life.
All of his life? And how long in Trigg County, actually, if you know?
In Trigg County, all of his life, except for maybe a few months and the years that he was in the penitentiary.
Where is the majority of yours and Jonathan's family from?
Right here in Trigg County.
Okay. Does, to your knowledge, does Jonathan have any friends or family out of the country?
No. Okay.
If the judge were to order Jonathan to remain at home or at your house, if he were released to your house, could that be accomplished?
Yes.
And if the judge were to order Jonathan to wear an ankle monitor at his own expense, could that be accomplished?
Yes.
Let me ask you, in the alternative, if the court were to order Jonathan to complete long-term treatment as a condition of his bond, would you be supportive of that?
Most definitely.
Do you think that that's something that he could benefit from?
Yes.
And then the last thing I want to ask you is, if the court were to release Jonathan on some type of bond, would Jonathan have transportation to court, to treatment, to pretrial services, anywhere the court may require him to be?
Yes.
And what would that transportation be?
My personal vehicle.
You would be willing to transport him to all of his court appearances?
Yes.
Thank you, miss. That's all I have.
Ms. Weaver, I've just got a few questions for you. Are you telling the court that you would be responsible for your son if he was released from custody on a bond?
Yes.
He's had a lot of behavioral issues over the years, hasn't he?
Yes.
And tell me where he was living when he was a juvenile, when he was charged with and convicted of two counts of kidnapping in Marshall County. He wasn't living with you, was he?
No.
Could you not control him?
That wasn't why.
Tell
That's
us why.
Not why he left.
Excuse me?
That's not why he left the home and went to live with his uncle.
Okay. So he was living with his uncle. He was not living with you as a even as a juvenile.
At that time. He wasn't there a year and all that happened.
So how long has he lived with you over his 45 years?
When he went to that, less than a year. I was pregnant. So less than a year of his home life.
But he's had a lot of behavioral issues over his life, hasn't he?
Objection, Judge.
I think it's a fair question if she's saying she's going to be responsible for him.
I'll allow the question.
Okay. What was the question again?
He's had a lot of behavioral issues.
Yes.
And he's been in prison, you heard testimony, probably about 25 years out of his life.
I know exactly. Yes, it was 25 years.
I mean, you're not honestly telling the court that you can control your son.
No, but I know how to pick up the phone and call the police if I can't control him.
But if he's gone or if he's already hurt somebody, that would be too late, wouldn't it?
It would be too late then.
Yes. No further questions.
Right. Anything else, Ms. Boyarsky? No. You may step down, Ms. Hoover. Thank you. Any other proof, Ms. Boyarsky?
No proof, Judge. Just argument, please.
Any proof from the Commonwealth?
No.
Well, I suppose you both have argument, and I'll let Ms. Ovie Wiggins give argument, and I'll give you, Ms. Boyarsky, I'll give the defense the closing for today. How about that, the final closing? Okay.
Your Honor, the court's got to look at Rule 4.16 and KRS 431066 when determining what an appropriate bond is. So under 416, bond's got to be commensurate with the gravity of the offense charged. Your Honor, we are dealing with multiple felonies that the defendant has been indicted for. Murder is the most serious crime punishable under the law. There is an aggravator in this case. The defendant is facing life imprisonment and the death penalty if he were to be convicted and the jury assesses a death verdict. The stakes are high in this case. Stakes are way too high to lower a bond. The bond's $2 million. Given the gravity of the offense and his criminal history, it's appropriate. Your Honor, I think I have to mention that over my career, I recall two defendants who have been charged with intentional murder, where a bond has been lowered and the defendant has posted the bond. In the first situation, in Caldwell County, we started
Judge,
the trial.
I would object to this argument. It's supposed to be an individualized determination on bond.
Well,
not
it's
compared to any other defendant.
Okay, so what you're saying is, is that you've had other persons released on murder bonds that have not done well.
They have not done well. And Your Honor, I would say that goes to the nature of the offense and the penalty that the defendant is looking at if he is convicted in this case. If he gets out of custody, what does he have to lose? He doesn't have much to lose. He's looking at a life in prison or the death penalty if convicted. The stakes are just too high for the court to lower the bond in this case. The court's also got to consider past criminal acts, 4 prior felonies, starting when he was a juvenile. I have listed those felonies in my response. We have talked about them here today. But even as a juvenile, he could not conform his conduct to the criminal laws of Kentucky. He has spent over half of his life incarcerated, 25 out of 45 years. So, a substantial criminal history. Reasonably anticipated conduct of the defendant. I don't think they can argue he's not at a high risk to reoffend because of his criminal history, because he just has shown over the years that he cannot comply with the criminal law. Financial ability to give bail, and I'm sure this is the one that the defense will harp on. Just because someone can't post a bond, that doesn't mean that it's excessive in and of itself. And there's a case on that, Your Honor. Long v. Hamilton, 467 Southwest 2D 139. So just because somebody can't post a bond, that doesn't mean it's excessive. Your Honor, I think we've talked about flight risk. I think he's absolutely a flight risk when he's facing life imprisonment or death. Danger to the public. This, you have heard, was a random act of violence. This victim was an innocent victim. The defendant entered her home and killed her. I think clearly if he were to be released based upon the allegations in this case as well as his criminal history that he's a danger to the public. The victims are in the courtroom today. I talked to them prior. To court, it is very clear that they oppose any modification in the bond. I could call them up here to say that, but I think the court should be well aware that the victims in this particular case do not want any modification in the bond. So I thank Your Honor taking into consideration what the court's got to consider under the law, that the bond is reasonable and it should not be modified.
Thank you, Ms. Obie Wiggins. Ms. Boyarski.
Judge, I believe that the court is aware that Kentucky courts and the U.S. Supreme Court have long held that less restrictive and oppressive means other than incarceration to ensure compliance with pretrial conditions are favored. Jonathan, we have pointed out, can live with his mother. He's willing to complete long-term treatment with an ankle monitor at his own expense. His history of cooperation and coming to court, his extensive ties to this community and the family support that he has will ensure that he will be present for all of his court appearances. And that is the purpose of bail. As the court is aware, Jonathan's been appointed a public defender as proof of his indigency. His wife testified about their financial abilities. They are not financially in a position to post this bond. The law states that every person accused of a crime in this country, Judge, is entitled to release with a bond they can make because of the presumption of innocence. As to the nature of the offense, while Jonathan is charged with serious crimes, we have offered a preview of the nature of this case to assure the court that he will not flee. He is not a flight risk because he has a viable defense. He has every interest in coming to court to get his not guilty verdict. there is evidence to support that John Jones is the uncharged perpetrator who accompanied Allison Hunter into the residence and committed these offenses. Jonathan McCoy is an innocent man who is being punished for one of dozens of individuals who happened to be on Reddick Pond Road on the day of the crime. This is supported by the total lack of forensic evidence connecting Jonathan to the crime. The only witness connecting Jonathan to the crime, or to the murder, is Allison Hunter, who has lied to the police more times than we can count during five different interviews in order to protect her love interest, John Jones. It would be possible for Allison to know the information that she knows and gave to the police if she entered that home with John Jones. It doesn't necessarily mean that she entered with Jonathan McCoy, and in fact, she never even brought up Jonathan McCoy's name until, I believe, the third interview with law enforcement. My point in all of this, Your Honor, is that Jonathan sits here an innocent man. Under the Constitution, he is presumed innocent. It is unfair, it is unlawful, it is unjust to hold a person in custody before trial without more evidence of guilt. What I've heard about this case, Judge, creates nothing but doubt as to the guilt of Jonathan McCoy. The evidence is just not there. It's no fault of Detective Hill. He investigated the case. He looked for the evidence, but it's not there. Holding an innocent man on unwarranted charges does not accomplish justice for Thelma Barnett or her family. He's been in custody almost 2.5 years without any new charges or disciplinary write-ups while in custody. He's had some medical issues that have been a burden on taxpayers. If he were released, he could pay for those at his own expense. The purpose of bail, Judge, is not preventative detention. Home incarceration is sufficient to supervise Jonathan. He's already demonstrated his tendency to appear for court dates and interviews while he was out of custody during this murder investigation. His ties to the community, as I mentioned, and his family that you heard from are key factors in assuring his continued presence in court. $2 million is what the bail is set at, and that's only for the murder charge. So his bail is in excess of $2 million. That amount of bail the Kentucky courts have held essentially serves as a denial. If the amount of bail is required so excessive as to be prohibitory, the result is a denial of bail, according to Atkins versus Reagan. The Commonwealth argued that Jonathan has a serious criminal history and that he serves, that shows that he's a danger to this community, Your Honor. The Kentucky court held in Salerno, actually it was the U.S. Supreme Court in U.S. versus Salerno held that it is required to show a specific danger to people in this community, to specific people in the community. There is nobody that is specifically in danger. There are no, like as Ms. O.B. Wiggins said, she believed that this was to be a random, that this was a random act. There has been no specific target or anything like that, or any mention of anybody that could possibly be in danger if he were released. The court also held in Long versus Hamilton that intentionally setting a bond so high that a defendant can't make it is impermissible, even to protect the community. It is impermissible to hold him, Judge. We respectfully request this court amend the bond to $50,000 unsecured, require Jonathan to wear an ankle monitor at his own expense to monitor his whereabouts, and order he reside with his mother, or in the alternative, if you'd like him to do something beneficial to himself and the community, he would be willing to complete long-term treatment as a condition of his bond. That's all the argument I have, Judge. I ask that you would issue a written order with findings of fact and conclusions of law in this matter.
And I shall. Thank you, Ms. Mayor. Thank you. Anything else, Ms. O'Brien?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. All right.
Well, thank you all, and I shall make a ruling in the near future. We are next set for a pretrial in this case. These cases win.
I don't think we have an okay. additional day.
So we probably need to set one, don't we? Okay. So we have rule day every second Wednesday at 9 a.m. Is there a particular time? We don't have to set a pretrial conference because we are set for trial. I mean, we have another date on the case that keeps it on our calendar. Do you all just want to keep it set for trial? We'd need another. We don't have to have another pretrial. No question about that.
Your Honor, can I suggest?
Okay.
Or can I request the court issue a scheduling trial order?
Yes.
And I think that will help us be able to determine when motions are going to file and when we need to set additional dates.
Thank you. And I had thought about that, and we need to do that. I will issue a scheduling order that is standard for the. Okay.
That'd be fine. And also, Judge, if I may, the defense anticipates filing an upcoming motion. So I would, for now, ask that we go ahead and put this on for a pretrial conference for the regular hour in April.
Okay. All right.
We have our motion filed at that time.
We can do that.
So is this a motion you're going to want to be heard at the April date or just to get a date on?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. April the 4th at 9 a.m. Okay. Is that right? No, I was Caldwell Rule Day. I'm sorry. Okay. April the 12th. April the 12th at 9.
April the
12th
at
9
a.m., Your Honor?
Yes. Uh-huh. So the court shall issue a scheduling order. We'll set this for a pretrial conference April the 12th, and I'll make a ruling on our bond motion. I'll also do a fourth order that indicates that the issue as to the Trig Lion Fire Department records has been at this time resolved. At this point in time, satisfied. Been satisfied for both parties, okay?
Judge, before we leave, may the defense approach on an ex parte matter?
Yes, you may.
Thank you.
Do you all wish to be heard in chambers?
I don't think it's okay. necessary. All just right. a quick question.
All right, let me. So is Ms. Stewart here as well? Okay. Ms. Ovi Wiggins is here. You all would stay in the courtroom for just a moment. I'm going to All right, so let's bring Ms. Stewart out this morning. Good morning, Ms. Stewart. Come on around. How are you today?
Good.
So I will call 21 CR 74, 21 CR 18, Commonwealth versus Keisha Stewart. And Ms. Stewart's case was set for today, and I believe it was on Wednesday. Your new attorney, Ms. Katie Riley, contacted Ms. Ovi Wiggins and I
and said that she didn't know that she could be here, but she was satisfied about the discovery, and there wasn't any pending motion, therefore, in your case. She indicated that she has spoken with you. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So I'm going to set your case for a pretrial in April.
Okay.
It will be on April the 12th at 9 o'clock, okay?
All right.
Thank you, Ms. Stewart.